Hey everyone, welcome back to Bitcoin Banter. As usual, I've got Tony and our newest guest, Rick, here as well. Rick, Tony, how you guys doing today?
Great, Michael. How are you? Good,
Doing
thanks.
well. Yeah. So hey, we're gonna kick it off here with some news. Did you guys see, did anything happen over the weekend?
Gee, I don't know, man.
Maybe I missed it. All righty, let's dive right in here. So former President Trump survives assassination attempt. And man, it's interesting. Like the first, I was kind of watching it. I was going to a soccer game that night, and I was keeping an eye on what was happening. And within just, a day, all of a sudden the conspiracies start coming out. And that's always going to happen, but some of this looks really, really dicey. I mean, from the Secret Service's perspective, how did this guy get on the roof? There's like video footage of spectators who were filming him and telling law enforcement that he was up there. It definitely doesn't look good, but we might have avoided civil war by an inch, by a turn of Trump's head. So fill me in on a foreign perspective as you consider this news.
Yeah, man, this was unbelievable news. When I heard it, like I was like I had to see it twice in order to really make sure this actually did happen. What an appalling and disgusting and disgraceful, shocking event that this took place. If you don't believe in God, you will after this, because this man, he avoided death by really like a fraction of a hair. Something moved his head at the right time in the right direction so that this bullet grazed his ear rather than, blowing up his head and, in front of everybody. But this was an epic fail on so many proportions. Like, I don't even know where to begin, whether it was, if you want to go down the conspiracy, road, I don't think it's conspiracy. There's a lot of, red flags, now that I've gotten a chance to read a bit what happened after the fact, as to how something such as an elite Secret Service could fail so spectacularly. It makes you wonder whether they really did fail because of incompetence or because they were following orders from somewhere. It doesn't make sense that some loser geek, 20-year-old nobody, gets on a building 130 meters away with a rifle, okay, with a perfect line of shot to the president who's making a speech, and nobody sees him. On top of it, like you said, people were telling cops about this, that they were looking at the guy, they see him for I don't know how many minutes before the fact. Nobody reacted. And then when the shooting took place, you've got this 5'2" Dunkin' Donut who can't protect anything. Who can't even find her gun holster, like you expect this thing to protect a president? I mean, this whole thing was that, well, like it was made to look like it was, just the way it happened. But if you take a step back and you analyze it, I mean, you have to be really retarded, to think that this is just a fluke and not something that could potentially have been intentionally organized and failed. But either way, Donald Trump, I'm not an American, okay, but I feel such a sense of American patriotism based on what he did. That sense of defiance, this will go down in history forever. This was like this would he won. That's it. Like
It's
he
over.
cemented history. It's finished. It's done. So I'm glad he's okay. I'm really glad he's okay, but it's disgusting what happened.
Yeah. Hey, Rick, I want your opinion, but real quick, just to follow up on Tony's, I'm going to share one more thing. The Babylon Bee, I don't know if you guys follow them or see their stuff. It says Secret Service beef up Trump's security squad with a squad of blind midgets. So I think they hit the nail on the head. But this is the result of DEI. I mean, I don't know if you guys saw that the head of Secret Service, her priority has been getting 30% female agents in. And I mean, DEI has been like a priority that she's been pushing. And hopefully the tides turn on that we begin to recognize, and it's not that there aren't women who are capable. It's that most of them aren't big enough to cover a guy who's, 6'2" or 3" or however tall Trump is. And It's there's a reason that historically men have gone to war and men have occupied these positions. So it's no knock on the small group of women who are completely capable of it, but for that to be a priority, I tweeted the other day. I said that DEI is the enemy of prosperity, but it's also the enemy of safety, and it's sad. Anyway, I'll Rick, where's your head at on all of this?
Man, I mean, where do you even begin with a story as insane as this? I mean, I'm still 50% on the fence as to whether I'm living in a simulation, whether you guys are actually even real, or this is all just some crazy dream from my Matrix pod. I don't know, but oh man, I mean the fact that a shooter could get within 150 yards of Donald Trump at a rally. From a rooftop, which was the closest rooftop to the stage, it beggars belief. You know, I don't work in the security services, but had you told me it was my job to protect the Trump at this rally, then one of the first things I would have done was made sure it was absolutely impossible to get to a rooftop. And also, you know, I'm like everyone else. I'm watching all the commentary, and you know, I've seen videos on Twitter of sort of trained sniper professionals commenting on it, and they're saying, you know, look, we can hit people from 1,000 yards. We're trained to track targets from 1,000 yards away, and nobody saw this guy apparently. Of course, apart from people in the crowd, right? And people in the crowd telling police there's a guy with a gun on the roof, and nothing happens. I find that remarkable. And when you look at some of the footage, you know, I mean, this is just my opinion, and it could be completely wrong, but I don't know. It looks a lot like the snipers had seen him before the shots were fired. I just don't know what to make of that. But look, you know, I've been wearing a tinfoil hat for a long, long, long time, and it wouldn't surprise me in the slightest if there was a conspiratorial element to this, only because the official story that we're gonna be fed about this, I think, is gonna be so ludicrous, and just not really particularly plausible. My biggest takeaway as a foreigner is, you know, look, I try not to get too much into American politics, but it's another sign of this overall degradation of society that we're living through. You know, if you went back 20, 30 years and told people these sorts of things would be happening all around us, they'd think that you were out of your mind, right? And the truth is, the world's just more dangerous. There's more division in America and actually everywhere in the world now between sort of warring factions. And to me, it's just a sad state of affairs and shows that, like, hey, look, you know, whatever happens, maybe priority number one needs to be looking after yourself and protecting yourself and thinking about if this thing goes turbo, what am I going to do? Because maybe if it all really kicks off, it might not matter whether your preferred candidate or political party gets into power. Because if society gets into a big enough mess, that's not really going to be your most pressing concern anymore. It's going to be your safety, your family's safety, access to food, access to money, all of these things. So if anything, a really good signal that you really need to be getting yourself prepared.
Yeah, no, that's well said. Scary times. It's to imagine what could have been if he'd been shot and killed. I mean, he's got such a love him or hate him, love his base or hate his base. He has such a strong base. I mean, he's such a brand. I think we'd live in a very different America and probably a different world today if it'd be one of those before and after. And I also think it's worth noting that I'm a huge advocate for free speech, obviously, but to attack Trump for an alleged insurrection a few years ago when he said go home, be peaceful, and all the calls that he's a Nazi and for them to take no responsibility for inciting violence is just the utmost of irony. And it's sad. Hopefully some of this the fear mongering from the mainstream media cools off a little bit after this, because they are if not directly, obviously the shooter is directly responsible, or maybe the Secret Service or the CIA or something, but they certainly aren't helping with his safety. So, all righty, we've got some more to cover. I know that was probably the longest bit we'll have, but so I think it was yesterday, Larry Fink went on CNBC and see he said I was wrong about Bitcoin, and he was a proud skeptic. And now he says Bitcoin gives you an opportunity to invest in something that is outside your country's control, then you have more financial control. It's for the longest time, I'll just give my quick take and then pass it to you guys. When the ETFs launched, my sense from Larry Fink was he was saying positive things for Bitcoin, but my sense was he really had no fundamental understanding of the asset. The more he talks now, like the longer this goes on, the more I sense he kind of gets it. He was talking about government debt and kind of the mess that we're in. Like it's like yes, like these are the real talking points. It's not about Bitcoin being this shiny, digital internet money. Some people don't view it as a hedge, but it can be a hedge. It can be, as he said a couple months ago, I think a flight to quality. So what are your takes on Larry Fink and his evolutionary understanding of Bitcoin?
Well, two things as far as I'm concerned. The first part being he's just like any other Bitcoiner, who starts off, as a skeptic. You doubt it. Is it it's so good to be true? It can't possibly be, and you go down the rabbit hole, trying to debunk all these myths. And so you only come to the conclusion, that this is the real deal when you do the work, you study, you ask questions, and eventually you understand how this thing is put together and you realize, that no, it's not a scam, it's not a fad, it's not coming and going, it's here and it's here to stay. But the second point, when I saw this video that concerned me, I don't know if you were paying attention or maybe it's just me, but he had a look of concern when he was making that, that conver when he was having that conversation. He looked like someone who was genuinely concerned, and he was sort of like issuing a warning without really making it sound like it's a warning. And when someone like that talks like this, like for me, I pay attention. Like that sets off an alarm bell telling me that he's trying to send a message without using certain words so that he doesn't trigger, certain reactions. But if he's warning people that this, or if he's legitimizing the asset, saying this is something that you should hold on to if you no longer believe in the system or you want to protect yourself from, an imminent collapse or whatever it is that you want to call it, you better listen, because this guy knows what he's talking about, and he certainly knows more details about what's happening behind the scenes than any one of us here. So if he's nervous, you better be petrified. This is the impression I got. I could be wrong, but like 20 years of dealing one-to-one with people, you sort of pick up on little cues. So what do you guys think? Am I completely off here?
I think I recognize that sense of concern, Rick.
Yeah, I mean, I find it fascinating to watch someone like Larry Fink talk about Bitcoin the way he does. I mean, this is going to sound almost a bit ridiculous because he's the biggest, he manages the biggest hedge fund in the world. But actually, I would like to try and pull him up on a couple of points that he made that I fundamentally disagree with his viewpoint on. So first and foremost, he constantly refers to Bitcoin as a financial instrument or an asset class or like digital gold. And actually, some of the terms he used in his little talk there was he said, look, if you're looking for uncorrelated returns. And the idea behind what he's saying there is that this is somewhere, Bitcoin is somewhere you can invest your money to make outsized returns if everything else is struggling, potentially, right? But for that premise to be true, it would also mean, well, what are we measuring those returns in? And if you're measuring those returns in dollars, then you can kind of think of it this way. He's suggesting that you invest in a superior type of money so that you can get a return in an inferior type of money. Now, to me, there's a breakdown in fairly rudimentary logic there, because then he also goes on to say how governments are debasing the currency and all this. So he's kind of saying invest in Bitcoin to earn more of this currency that the government are currently debasing and is the point in the first place. And for me, I mean, maybe I've been around too long and I'm too deep in the Bitcoin rabbit hole now, but for me, Bitcoin just simply isn't a speculative asset. It's kind of a weird, it's a paradigm shift in your thinking, and I would imagine he'll get there eventually as well. But to me, Bitcoin is not an asset. It's just a superior money. In fact, we've got an article on our website that I put together called Bitcoin is Not a Speculative Asset. And I think, you know, if people went and read that, they might look at it in a slightly different way. But let's bear in mind that Larry Fink's business is predicated on selling you ETF shares, not actual Bitcoin. So for his product and service to make any sense at all, it has to offer you a return in dollars. So he's always going to be measured. He's never going to go as far as this as to call it money or that you should hold it outside the system. And I'd also question that if he's putting a warning out there that the current system is in bad shape or struggling, then surely the last thing you want to do is invest your money into a Bitcoin ETF, which is inherently tied and linked to this system, you know. But look, that's the position he's in. And I wish as well we would hear less talk about this is only the asset you go to if you're frightened and scared of the future world. Because for me, the opposite is true. Yes, I hold my wealth in Bitcoin because I don't see any value in dollars or fiat currencies. And yes, it's a great hedge if that whole world collapses. But that's only half of the story. You know, I'm interested in Bitcoin because it opens up entirely new business models. It opens up entirely new ways for us to transact and move value around the world. And just like when we invented the internet, right? It's going to create entirely new industries that we can't even fathom yet. So rather than it just being a thing that's you're driven to through fear, I think the size of the opportunity is enormous as well. So you're not running away from anything. I think you're running towards something and running towards something that's better.
I think
Yeah, but
that's
like you said,
well said.
he's not in a position to admit this right away, right? I don't think
Sure.
he's in a position to just come out and say this, but I'm sure he understands this now.
Yeah, I think it's a little bit like Michael Saylor is the CEO of a publicly traded company. He's a bit more measured in how he frames Bitcoin and its utility and its value, you know, as scarce digital property. And he, you know, he has sort of his slogans that he and they're all valid and obviously very useful, I think, for a lot of people, probably especially in traditional finance or in corporate America. But you don't hear Michael Saylor coming out and saying the government's on the verge of collapse, they're going to default or print, you know, like, and it's just a matter, I think, in a reality of the position in which someone like that finds himself. And Larry Fink is no different. And Larry Fink is probably much more embedded with government than someone like Michael Saylor is. So I think that's a
Absolutely,
really good point.
absolutely.
Okay, let's see. We've got so Trump announced his vice presidential candidate, JD Vance of Ohio. I don't know if you guys know much about JD Vance. I just know a little bit. He sort of came on the scene. I think back in 2016, he published a book called Hillbilly Elegy. And he was from a, I mean, he's a really smart guy. Graduated, I think, from Ohio State in 2 years, got his law degree at Yale, one of the, you know, top law schools in the country. He owns 6% of his portfolio is in Bitcoin, just came out. So I don't know if this is signal or just coincidental. Trump speaking at, you know, in Nashville, the Bitcoin conference next week. It seems as it's still on. What do you think the implications of a such a high profile individual, likely the next vice presidential candidate or the next vice president of the United States, particularly if the election is fair? Thoughts on his adoption of Bitcoin? By the way, it is an ETF. I don't know that he does or doesn't own, you know, self custody in Bitcoin too, but it's to me it's still you know it's an indication of something.
I just learned about this guy today, you know, when I've never heard of him before, but you know, from the little that I know of him right now, he seems to be a solid contender, at least someone who understands Bitcoin a lot more than everyone else, you know, in his position, you know, at least in politics. Donald Trump's position on Bitcoin, you know, whether you think it's for votes or if he genuinely believes it, terrifies the current party. That's a fact. Okay. In fact, there was a recent article in Forbes where Janet Yellen admits that they are petrified of Donald Trump because he's going to cement Bitcoin in place, and that's going to automatically unlock a flow about $4 trillion into the asset, sending it to a fiat value of anywhere between 150 to over 200,000, you know, causing a massive hit to the US dollar. This is a Forbes article. I have the link to it. You know, we can share it later on, but this is, you know, publicly available. And so, you know, Bitcoin is playing a major role now in it's not a political asset, but you know, it's being used as one. And Donald Trump is using it, I guess, to you know, return sanity to America, like to literally make America great again, and to hopefully, you know, turn the tides of this darkness and this division that's been destroying the country.
Rick?
Yeah, it's fascinating. I think you make a really good point that, you know, he holds FBTC. So currently he doesn't have any Bitcoin. So, you know, his allocation in my view is currently 0% because if you buy ETF shares, you don't own any Bitcoin. You have a claim on some Bitcoin and maybe you'll get it if you ask for it. You know, but I don't even think you can withdraw Bitcoin from these things, right? So
Yeah.
yeah, but again, look, you know, my view on this is that it's funny to me because we talk about like politicians using Bitcoin for their own ends, right? Whether that's votes, whether they really believe in it. Let me spin that on its head just a little bit, right? Because I think that actually Bitcoin is making all the politicians work for it. So I'll explain, right? So Bitcoin, through its, you know, brilliant incentive system, first of all, it employs, like we always talk about AI employing humans in the future. It's like, guys, this happened 15 years ago. Bitcoin, through its incentives, hires miners to secure the network. And then at a certain point, it hired me to promote it, right? You know, because I was running around doing Bitcoin talks all over the UK. And then, you know, it's hired Tony to come and talk about it and teach people how to use it. It's the reason we're on this podcast. I think we're heading to a world where we all work for Bitcoin, right? One way or the other. And, you know, like we spoke about last week, Donald Trump has been the first to get a new job as a promoter of Bitcoin. And I expect the rest of them will all be getting some positions as well. So yeah, I mean, everything's bullish for Bitcoin, right? And they're all gonna bend the knee to it and start supporting it eventually because the alternative is, well, they'll get left behind and forgotten about. So yeah, I'd love to see more of the same.
Yeah, well, you're right. He may own zero Bitcoin unless he's been buying peer-to-peer, non-KYC, and you know, Tony secretly, you know, taught him how to custody it properly. But
You know, there's NDAs involved here. You know, I can't say anything.
but he has 6% of his net worth betting that Bitcoin will appreciate in value, is effectively the statement he's making, whether or not he has real Bitcoin or not. And I think that's considerable. I mean, from an IQ perspective, he's got to be double or triple Kamala Harris. And so I think just having someone in a VP position who's going to have some influence, who has a stake in the game to say, hey, the reason I do this is because I think here's where it's going, I think could be interesting. I mean, the evolution of Trump's position on Bitcoin has been striking. There is someone in his ear. Yeah, the fact that they're talking about self-custody, that we talked a few weeks ago about the Republican Party, I think maybe last week, about the Republican Party's official platform, anti-CBDC, pro-mining, pro-self-custody. I mean, they're using language that, and props to David Bailey at Bitcoin Magazine. I think my sense is, if he's, you know, not bluffing on Twitter, he's had a sizable impact on the position that the Republican Party has taken here. So everything's good for Bitcoin. This is, I think, very good for Bitcoin. So exciting times.
Well, here's a thought for you about this ETF. What are the chances that the American ETF becomes an in-kind at some point with Trump?
That's a good question. Well, it's a good question. I don't know. I'm not a finance guy. I don't know like what the legal implications of that are. Like if that's something they can just turn on, if there are laws against it. I'm not sure. Like the
Well,
F
think about it. If he's publicly stating, "I protect your right to self-custody and to keep the goons away from your Bitcoin," you know, so what's the if so they're technically legitimizing it on all fronts. So then what's to keep them from saying, "Okay, well, this ETF now is an in-kind ETF." And so imagine you've got these billions of dollars, you know, in this ETF that all of a sudden understand what this self-custody thing means, and they can withdraw it into real
The Bitcoin way will be doing very well once people realize
Bitcoin.
what the ETFs represent. We're gonna get busy.
I think that's a major game changer, man.
Yeah,
I really hope
because Hong
it's
Kong's
on the
doing
card
that.
somewhere.
Yeah,
Yeah.
Hong Kong's already doing that. And so to the extent that this
Absolutely.
turns into a competitive environment for ETFs, I think that's it's certainly something that I mean, down the road, I think that's definitely the case. I don't know
100%.
mechanically how easy or difficult that is, but yeah, it's a great thought. All righty, last one, guys. This is just for fun. Bitcoin is pumping. We're back. We're at let's see, we're at the moment, yeah, 63,800 US dollars. Are we does anything stop this train? Do you think we see any more dips? We've seen a lot of sell-off from Germany, a failing nation. Any thoughts on where we're headed over the next few months? Price predictions,
Well,
welcome.
no price predictions, man. These are like silly. But there's three catalysts, three clowns. Okay, we got rid of one of them, the German government. They're out of the game now. So who's left? You've got the Mt. Gox possible sell-off, you know. So you've got, you know, maybe a percentage of these guys that want to sell for whatever reason. And then you've got the US government that still has a whole bunch. Who knows what they decide to do with it. Other than these two, I don't see any major, you know, catalyst to sell. I mean, a lot of the weak hands and lettuce hands are, for the most part, I think, out of the game. And so whoever is left is, you know, are those that understand what it is that they're holding. So maybe we see a little dip. I mean, we dipped a little bit today. You know, I think the Mt. Gox movement starts to happen within 7 to 14 days, if I recall reading it right. Who knows, man? I mean, it would be pretty silly from someone in a Mt. Gox position to sell, in my opinion. Like, I mean, if I was waiting 10 years, especially if I'm just paying attention to what just happened in the last 48 hours, to come about and sell now, unless I've got like some crazy emergency that I need to tend to, it would be like the dumbest move ever to engage in something like this, you know? Especially considering how much of it they must own since they bought it at peanuts, you know, 10 years ago.
Yeah, I did see from I was looking for a tweet. I thought it was Tur de Meester, maybe it was someone else. Their take was only 20% or so of the Mt. Gox distributions are going to sell because these are OGs who understand Bitcoin, understand the value. And so you've got 80% of it's going to continue to be held, except for people, you know, looking to pay off their house or buy their Lamborghini or whatever. But the sell pressure, I think the last, you know, week or so has it seems to have come from Germany, and I think they finished their sell off. So, Rick, where are we headed?
Oh man, I know exactly where we're headed. If you look at the chart, right, it's going to go up and it's going to go to the right and it's going to keep on doing that forever until the dollar is dead. So I try and stay away from all this price speculation stuff if I can. Maybe I can offer some perspective, right? Because I was lucky enough that when we first bought Bitcoin, it was like, I don't know, $50, $100, so somewhere around there, right? And funnily enough, we bought those coins on Mt. Gox. So before I was hacked, unfortunately, earlier, well, late last year, and lost all those coins, the truth is, you know, I'd sat through close to 40,000% increase in value, right? Now, I could have been one of those Mt. Gox creditors. The real cruel thing in my story is that we made the right decision by taking self-custody and avoiding the hack. And if I'd have left it there, I'd have at least got like 16% of my coins back. So funnily enough, those guys did better than me somehow, miraculously. But what I can do is say, look, over those 10 years, having bought the coins on Mt. Gox, I just don't see this world where all these guys are going to sell these coins, right? I know guys that I've been friends with for 5, 10 years who used Mt. Gox, and 90% of them, I would say, know exactly what they're doing. There will be some sell pressure, right? Because like some people, like you say, they'll buy a house or they'll, spend it, or some people might just not be in a great financial position and have to sell it. But I think the vast majority of them are going to be pretty clued up compared to your average sort of Bitcoiner out there. So I'm not concerned about Mt. Gox coins. As for Germany and all this other stuff, I mean, that's wild, man. I mean, talk about not going to make it. Wow, what an absolute. I mean, one thing that's fun for me is that, like, yeah, I might own more Bitcoin now than Germany. So maybe I'm not as far behind as I
You
was worried about.
absolutely, you
I think, yeah.
absolutely. As long as you have more than
Hey,
$2 worth.
look, you know what's
That's
funny? It's
wild.
like, oh man, put yourself in my shoes, right? I would love it if every Mt. Gox creditor sold their coins. I hope everybody sells their Bitcoin. When I see red candles, man, I start salivating at the mouth. I'm so excited. So I very much doubt that we're going to see a huge price crash. But I would love to see one. And if you've really grokked Bitcoin, if you really understand it, you should be hoping for the same thing. I find it hard to understand why everyone celebrates green candles, because I'm thinking, well, you have all the Bitcoin you want. You don't want to acquire more of this stuff. But hey, there it is. As for price predictions, oh man, look, 40,000% in about a decade. I don't think it will be as crazy the returns as that for the next decade, because obviously was a hugely more speculative bet back then. But I think people vastly underestimate the upside potential of Bitcoin in general. I think even perhaps the most bullish people probably still underestimate it. I mean, the idea to me that Bitcoin could be $1 million in 2 years from now, 1 year from now, I wouldn't write that off. I don't think that sounds crazy at all. I think it could surprise all of us.
$1 million is a speed bump, man. It's nothing. Like what's $1 million? If Trump wins the elections, right there and then could be half a million.
I think the only thing, the challenge is that individual adoption is increasing, but it's slow, right? It's once you get big money behind it, pension funds, which we've got one who allocated a small amount, a well-run pension fund, by the way, one that's 99% funded, unlike all of the rest that are just dying and will be unable to pay, their creditors. But I think the next wave that's going to take us to higher heights is going to be institutional adoption, and it's things like Larry Fink making these statements that give people the green light. Like most financial advisors right now, they don't have the green light because their company, or the chief investment officer is, oh, it's still speculative. And L Larry Fink keeps this sort of language up on very public outlets. I think that dialogue is going to change within these other financial firms. So that's my take on it. Gentlemen, I think we covered everything we want to cover. Thank you guys for joining. For everyone listening, thank you so much. Of course, if you need help with your Bitcoin self-custody, which you probably do, check out thebitcoinway.com/podcast, schedule a call with the team. If you're lucky enough, you'll get to talk to Tony. Otherwise, we got some other great talent to guide you through the custody setup that would be best for you, and then to help you do that step by step with a white glove service. Gentlemen, appreciate your time. We'll talk again soon.
Absolutely, man.
You
Thank
bet.
you.
Cheers, everyone.
Cheers.